Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. So, as you can tell from up here, I'm merely going to invoke the ghosts of the Supreme Court past. So, this is all an exercise in imagination. The judges will be coming out soon. My name is Nicholas Mosvik, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Mississippi. So, I study the Civil War, Reconstruction period's constitutional history. And I am also a proud graduate of this institution, though it's been quite a long time since I've been here. I'm very excited to be part of this symposium. So for those of you who have, I'm assuming, has everyone got into this case in con law? Is that fair to assume or no? Okay. So Slaughterhouse is a case, as most of you probably know, that's fairly controversial and has been since the day it was decided. So the purpose of this re-argument is pedagogical. So it's educational, right? It's to help familiarize everyone here with the key facts and the types of arguments that were originally raised using a few primary examples, principally talking about the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So originally, this bench memorandum was created for an earlier conference on the history of the 14th Amendment, put on by the Institute for Justice and the Antonin Scalia School of Law in September. So you might assume that the deck is stacked in favor of overturning the law, but that's not true. We've taken a very serious time to make sure that all arguments are presented. And it's, as I say, to give an intellectually honest reassessment of these arguments presented against the Louisiana statute in question. Of course, in 1872, when the argument was heard by the Supreme Court, they heard literally days, given how lengthy the briefing was. They heard the case, in fact, a total of two times. And in the lower courts, so this started in the Louisiana state courts and the lower federal courts, there was a total of some 11 arguments. So if we were really doing this, we would be here literally all weekend. Tomorrow, you might hear about the Equal Protection Clause, Saturday, the Due Process Clause, and maybe next week, we'd get to the 13th Amendment. So, in other words, this case was incredibly complicated, and thus, we've tried to reduce it to one single question for exactly that purpose, right? Otherwise, this would take a very long time. So the Slaughterhouse cases were the first major test of the meaning of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868 after the Union's victory in the Civil War. And it's the first test at the Supreme Court level. It had been a mere 4 years since the amendment had been ratified and 6 years since the Reconstruction Congress first began to draft the amendment. So for those of you who are curious, Kurt Lash has written and talked a lot about those intervening periods, right? So in other words, if you're asking the question why it took 1866 to 1868 to be ratified, there's a complex history there that has to do with not only the drafting itself, but the ratification process. So this is the first major test. And the cases presented an opportunity for the Supreme Court to determine just how revolutionary the amendments were in terms of how they altered the Constitution's structure of federalism and the meaning of citizenship after the Civil War, which had forcibly ended slavery. So the Slaughterhouse decision has been criticized by scholars across the ideological and jurisprudential spectrum because it struck down a core protection underneath the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Randy Barnett, who was here earlier but unfortunately had to leave, has observed three theories to understand the case. The narrative of public health, advocated by scholars like Michael Ross, which suggests that Louisiana was merely using its state police powers to clean up the abattoirs in the river from all the waste from butchering. There's the narrative of corruption and bribery, which I think one of our advocates will probably get to. Which suggests, of course, that the legislator was corrupt in how they structured this corporation. And finally, the narrative of race. So Barnett importantly observes that while the narrative of race appears to scholars like Michael Ross and Jonathan Lurie to suggest that Slaughterhouse was correctly decided because it had upheld the decision-making of a biracial legislator, right? So at this time, Louisiana, for this brief period, is a biracial legislator. He believes that this ignores the fact that former Attorney General Jeremiah Black, who argued the case for the state of Louisiana, understood Slaughterhouse to be a case which severely limited the goals of Reconstruction. This is exactly, in fact, why Black took the case, right? This was one of many cases, including ex-parte McCardle, by which he wanted to limit the goals of Reconstruction. Other scholars, like Akhil Mar, have said that virtually no serious modern scholar, left, right, or center, thinks Slaughterhouse to be a plausible reading of the 14th Amendment. So for Amar, he looks to English common law and other sources for the pre-1866 rights that he believes are protected by the Privileges and Immunities Clause, right? So some unenumerated rights. Michael Stokes Paulson adds traditional common law privileges, so again, kind of this small set of unenumerated rights. And finally, at the Supreme Court level, Justice Thomas has talked about the Privileges or Immunities Clause in several notable cases. So first, in 1999, in Sands versus Roe, he noted that the Slaughterhouse decision essentially read the Privileges or Immunities Clause out of the Constitution. Thomas showed his desire to revitalize the original meaning of this clause and to incorporate any rights, right, the Bill of Rights, under it, in both this case and then later McDonald versus City of Chicago in 2010. In McDonald, Thomas quoted at length from Justice Bushrod Washington's opinion in Coryell versus Corfield. For those of you who don't know, Corfield is an 1823 case that goes over the privileges or immunities given to citizens, right? So it's defines them as the natural and fundamental rights of all free citizens. And Thomas argued that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to follow Washington's definition. And if you're watching the news, you'll know that just last week, Thomas discussed the clause again in the case of Timms versus Indiana. So Timms was the asset forfeiture case, victory for the Institute for Justice, by the way. And Thomas again reiterated his desire to revitalize the Privileges or Immunities Clause and use it as the means of incorporating the Bill of Rights against the states. And it appears that Justice Gorsuch is now also on board with this project. So at issue in Slaughterhouse is a law which granted the Crescent City Company, which was comprised of 17 individuals, so holding stock in a public company, named in the statute, and they were given the sole authority to establish the location at which animals for food could be landed and slaughtered in the city of New Orleans. The act gave the company the exclusive privilege of conducting and carrying on the livestock landing and slaughterhouse business. It also ordered that all their slaughterhouses within the city limits be closed, mandated that butchers had to pay the company to use the state-sanctioned facility, and created fines for off-site butchering of up to $250. The question presented for purposes of this exercise is, does the Louisiana Act, number 118, which granted this exclusive 25-year monopoly to the Crescent City Company, violate the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment by abridging the petitioner's right to earn a living subject to reasonable regulation? So before we get started, I'm going to go over a little ground rules for how this exercise will work. The petitioners, so the butchers who are challenging the law, will go for the first 21 minutes, and the respondent, the monopoly company in the state of Louisiana, will then have 25 minutes to respond. The petitioners get the last word with a four-minute rebuttal. The judges and advocates will suspend reality and pretend like this argument is taking place at the court in 1872. and will stick largely to the arguments referenced in the memorandum prepared for them. But given their knowledge and expertise, we also expect them to engage with their real-life jobs as judges as well. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce our advocates, all of which have incredible resumes. I can seldom do them justice, but I will try to anyways. Albert Lin, counsel for the petitioners, is the former Solicitor General of the state of West Virginia and is currently at Hunton Andrews Kurth in Richmond. He clerked for Justice Thomas and as Solicitor General won a monumental victory before the Supreme Court when he was granted a stay on behalf of more than two dozen states from the EPA's Clean Power Plant under President Obama. Dominic Dre, counsel for the respondents, is currently the Solicitor General of Arizona and was previously the Deputy Solicitor General. He clerked for Judge Edith Jones of the Fifth Circuit. Our judges, who will be coming out next, need even less introduction, but again, I will do so anyways. D.C. Circuit Judge Thomas Griffin is a proud UVA law grad, class 1985, who worked in private practice, is counsel for Brigham Young University, and is senior legal counsel of the United States, a nonpartisan position, before being appointed to the bench in June 2005. Judge Diane Sykes has been a judge since 1992, when she won election to the state trial bench in Milwaukee County, before she was appointed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1999 by Governor Tommy Thompson. After 12 years as a state court judge, she was appointed to the Seventh Circuit in 2004. And finally, Judge John Bush spent 27 years in private practice and represented former President Reagan during the Iran-Contra investigations. He was also president of the Louisiana chapter of the Federalist Society before he was nominated and confirmed to the Sixth Circuit in 2017. And with all that, we will go ahead and begin the proceedings.
All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States, oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of the United States are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. Our case this afternoon is the Butchers Benevolent Association of New Orleans versus the Crescent City Livestock Landing. Mr. Lin, whenever you're ready.
Madam Chief Justice, good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Albert Lin, and I'm here on behalf of the petition of Butchers. And if I may, I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
There are three points that, taken together, lead to the conclusion that the 25-year monopoly granted to the Crescent City Company violates the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. First, the Privileges or Immunities Clause of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment protects unenumerated rights from interference by state legislatures. Second, those unenumerated rights include the right to earn a living subject to reasonable regulation. And third, the 25-year monopoly granted by the state of Louisiana is not a reasonable regulation. Turning to the first point, it is clear from the text of the 14th Amendment and from the circumstances surrounding its enactment that the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects unenumerated traditional fundamental rights. The concept of privileges and immunities is not new. The concept of privileges.
Mr. Lin, we're dealing with a text here in the 14th Amendment that's similar to, but not precisely the same as, Article 4. So let's start there. If you're going to talk about text,
yes,
what do we learn about the 14th Amendment's use of privileges and immunities from Article 4's use of privileges or immunities.
I think we learned quite a bit, Your Honor. I think the ordinary reader of this clause in the 14th Amendment would believe that the meaning of privileges or immunities is informed by Article 4. And Justice—
In what way? Textually. They're different, though, right?
Slightly.
What's the difference, is it a difference that means anything to us?
Parts of the differences are meaningful, and parts are not.
So let's start with the meaningful parts.
The meaningful differences. Yeah. The Article 4 of the Comity Clause, as some call it, says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. So in the several states—
There's no reference there to national citizenship, is there?
No, there is just reference to citizenship.
What about the 14th Amendment?
The 14th Amendment says no state shall abridge, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
So there's a difference. Is that a meaningful one? One makes reference to citizenship of the United States. The other does not. Is that a meaningful difference?
I think it is slightly, but I think what it means is that the scope of rights covered by the 14th Amendment is broader. So I think let's start, if I may, with the language that is the same, privileges, immunities of citizens. Both refer to those things, and the most widely known exposition of that phrase is in Corfield by Justice Washington.
Which was after Article 4, though, right?
It was decided after Article 4 was ratified. Yeah. But it is well accepted in the public sphere that was a fair reading.
Is that right? I'm not certain that's the case. I think there's some scholarship that suggests that Justice Washington, first of all, it was dictum in that case, right? It was dictum, and that it perhaps was a novel explication of the phrases privileges and immunities. So it's not an uncontroverted point.
I think by the time of the enactment of the 14th Amendment, it was fairly well uncontroverted. Perhaps at the time that Justice Washington issued his opinion in the 1820s. But by 1868, we had a number of individuals in Congress, both on the House side and on the Senate side, who were referring—
Yeah, see, that's a different point. What I was trying to get is here we've got two provisions of the Constitution that use very similar language, right? And so if we're starting with the text, one of the provisions predates the other. We're starting with the text. I want to get a better understanding of what's the relationship between Article 4 and the 14th Amendment. And honing in on trying to figure out the meaning of Article 4, I think we start there. I don't think we jump to the meaning of the 14th Amendment, as it might be, that might be different, right? Even though they're the same words, somehow by the 1860s, those words may have changed their meaning in the public understanding. I'm trying to focus on what do we get in Article 4? What does that refer, starting there, what does that refer to? And can that inform our understanding of its later use in the Reconstruction Congress?
I take your point, Your Honor, but I think an important distinction here is I don't think it's necessarily relevant whether Justice Washington got it right terms of what Article 4 means, because the question is, what was the public understanding of the meaning of the phrase privileges?
So even if he got it wrong, you're saying—
Yes.
By the Reconstruction Congress, they're looking to his view, perhaps.
That's what I'm saying. My point, Your Honor, is whether he got Article 4 right or wrong, his characterization and description of what those words meant, I think our understanding is that it was well established by 1868 that that's what privileges or immunities of citizenship means, which is fundamental rights, traditional fundamental rights of a citizen of a free state. He has a three-part explanation of it where he says rights which are, quote, in their nature fundamental, which belong of right to the citizens of all free governments, and which have at all times been enjoyed by the citizens of the several states which compose this union. And then he goes on to provide a list, but says it's a non-exhaustive list of rights. And I think we would posit, Your Honor, that is the understanding of the phrase privileges or immunities of citizenship that was well understood in the public just a couple years ago.
Doesn't this little colloquy we've had, however, illustrate a fundamental problem with your originalism, your approach of originalism here? You're not a historian. I don't think you are. I'm not a historian. Isn't this the realm of historians and not judges and lawyers? Aren't we just sort of doing what we used to call law office history? And isn't that a dangerous way to go about construing the Constitution? I'm not going to say the 14th Amendment is an ink blot, but it certainly isn't clear, right? I mean, there's substantial arguments on both sides as to what this, on many sides, as to what this phrase means.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a hazard of the trade. As lawyers and judges, we interpret language, and language is informed by context and history. And we have the advantage of looking at this clause in a time that's relatively near to its enactment. So I think we all know relatively well what the public understanding of the phrase privileges or immunities is at this time. But I take your point that it does require historical analysis. The way we understand the contract that was made, which is what the Constitution is, between the citizens and their government, is to understand how the citizens would understand the meaning of those words.
Is it plausible to claim that the ratifying generation understood that the effect of this language was to shift all rights of state citizenship, all common law rights of state citizenship, to the national government for protection? In other words, that all pre-existing rights of state citizenship and any henceforward declared would also be rights of national citizenship as well and enforceable by Congress and the federal courts?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, I think, just to make sure that my point is clear, we're not trying to figure out what the intent of John Bingham was, or any of the individuals who wrote or ratified it, but how they would have understood the clause on its plain text. But then the second answer to your question in terms of the consequences, the 14th Amendment was ratified soon after we had fought the only civil war in the history of this country, at a time when, after the enactment of the 13th Amendment, many of the states in the South were continuing to flout what the point of that amendment was by enacting invidious laws aimed at African-American citizens and depriving them of their rights. And so I think the concept of the 14th Amendment changing the national and state balance is not something radical given the circumstances. I think that was both the intent and the understood meaning of what the Privileges or Immunities Clause would do.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question about, you said the unenumerated rights, I believe you were arguing that they're fundamental. So how do you determine whether a right is fundamental, and then the particular right you're arguing for here as being unenumerated and being protected, why do you say that that's fundamental?
Well, I think if we're, as we suggest you should, looking to Justice Washington's analysis, you can look at these questions that he asked. In their nature, fundamental, natural rights, which belong of right to the citizens of all free government, and which have at all times been enjoyed by the citizens of the several states. It's a historical analysis where you look at the kinds of rights that have been understood. Now, an important caveat, not necessarily legally enforceable, right, but rights that citizens have. And so you can go back, and as to the specific right that we're talking about, the right to earn a living, and you can look in the history of England, and you can see that there, English citizens were always understood to have a number of rights, whether it was articulated in the Magna Carta, or the Bill of Rights, or the Petition of Rights, that were rights inherent in citizenship that were not necessarily legally enforceable, unless they are enumerated or encapsulated in the legal text. And as far as the right to earn a living, if we go back to our English history and the English common law, you can start with Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations talking about the right to pursue a living. Sir Edward Coke in The Case of the Monopolies, also in his famous writings, The Institutes of the Laws of England, where he says, all grants of monopolies are against the ancient and fundamental laws of the kingdom. But even coming more to the present, between Corfield and 1868, so in the 40 years that we're talking about, there are at least 60 cases. We did our research and found them all. At least 60 cases in which federal courts and state courts have held things like Sewell versus Jones, statutes which impose restrictions upon trade or common occupations, which levy an excise or tax upon them, must be construed strictly. The Rumpf case out of Illinois, which involved a monopoly on slaughterhouses. The Norwich Gaslight case out of Connecticut. Repeated cases where you see, so Your Honor, the short answer to your question is you look at this history and you see what are the rights that have always been understood to be inherent in citizenship. And those are the fundamental rights.
Aren't you arguing for too much here? Why don't you just focus, instead of inviting us to look at all these unenumerated rights that might be out there, why don't you just focus on the right to pursue a lawful trade?
Yes, Your Honor. And all of these, yeah. I'm sorry, and all of, so to the point, all of these things that I have cited, Sir Cook, the 60 cases.
And that's old.
Yes.
That's old and deep.
But the 60 cases between the 1820s and the 1860s in the United States that all talk about how monopolies, how there is a common right, common law antithesis, common law right against monopolies.
Were those cases involving, though, nuisances to the public like we've got here? Apparently there's a real health issue in New Orleans.
Some of them, yes, Your Honor, like the Rumpf case out of Illinois. And another one involving the Norwich Gaslight case, I believe, involved a public nuisance, but escapes me exactly.
What about that issue? Isn't the state entitled to have regulation that would address that problem?
It is, Your Honor. And so to where I started was it's a right to earn a living subject to reasonable regulation. And we are not taking issue with every aspect of the Louisiana law here. The fact that, for instance, prohibiting the presence of a slaughterhouse within certain areas of the city is understandable and can be justified as a reasonable regulation in the interest of public health.
But why isn't it reasonable to have a single place for slaughtering of animals instead of just having free-form, you know, competition where slaughterhouses can come up, can spring up anywhere? Isn't there an interest in trying to regulate this so that the slaughtering is just done in one particular location?
Well, Your Honor, I think you could say one particular location, but I don't know that there's a public health justification for having it a single building under the ownership of one single entity. I can't see a public health distinction between that and saying here within this section of the city and these square miles there can be slaughterhouses and various individuals.
Well, wait a second. Maybe I misunderstand it. Your clients are still, they can still butcher, right? They just have to pay a fee, right?
They do, but they can't engage in the running and owning of a slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. That ordinary occupation has been completely eliminated by the state's 25-year monopoly. And I think it's really that one aspect of it is all this court, Your Honor, to your point about a sort of a narrow approach here. You don't have to look at any of the other aspects of this law. The 25-year monopoly itself is not justified by any reasonable public health interest.
Well, your clients still have the right to earn a living. They just have to pay a fee as part of that, right? I mean, they still can have their businesses.
They have the right to actually chop up the animals, but they don't have the right to run a slaughterhouse. And that itself is an ordinary living that is being infringed on.
Are you saying a citizen has the right to engage in any profession the citizen wants? Is that your argument, that it's a fundamental right that the citizen can do any job?
With some exceptions, Your Honor, but yes. Our argument is that there is a right to, thank you, there is a right to earn, to have an ordinary living, to undertake any among the various many ordinary livings that there are, shoe cobbler, butcher, run a slaughterhouse, subject to reasonable regulation. And it can be regulated to varying degrees. And sometimes, perhaps, you can have things where you're required to have an apprenticeship, depending on the amount of skill that's required in order to protect the public health. But you cannot, through a monopoly, eliminate one of these ordinary livings in its entirety. And that is what the 25-year monopoly
is. How is this any different than common carrier statutes? I mean, we give to the state the authority to create monopolies in that way. How is this any different than that?
There is a history, Your Honor, of monopolies that are granted for sort of public franchises.
Right.
And the difference there is that those are all endeavors that are inherent in the state, that are obligations of the state. And the state, in choosing how it's going to provide those services, can delegate that authority to one individual or multiple individuals. But we're not talking about, and so when we go through the history to determine what is the scope of the fundamental right to earn a living, I would concede and carve out public franchises and things that are inherently of a state-given, state-run nature. We're talking here about an ordinary calling that is not inherently a part of state-provided services and an obligation of the state.
Why isn't it more reasonable to read the privileges or immunities clause in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment as limited to the rights that are secured by the structural constitution in the first 8 amendments, because those are indisputably rights of citizens of the United States? Isn't that a more reasonable reading?
Your Honor, with respect, it's not, given the understanding of the phrase privileges or immunities of citizenship. I think the problem with that...
But the 14th Amendment says privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's nothing by reference or by, you know, incorporating by reference the privileges or immunities and immunities of citizens of the several states.
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States are privileges or immunities that are, and this is why I had mentioned earlier that I think it's actually broader than the rights covered by the Comity Clause, because the United States is a free government. And so
why does it need to be broader? Why can't it just be different? That there are a set of rights that emerge out of the fact that we have a United States that are different than the set of rights that emerge out of you being a citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Why does it need to be, why isn't it just different? Is there anything in the language of the Constitution that compels your reading?
Let me take a step back, if I may, to the Comity Clause. I don't think what Justice Washington was saying there and what the understanding of the phrase privileges or immunities of citizens is limited to privileges or immunities of being the citizen of a state. I think what he was saying, what that phrase is understood to mean, is that there are certain privileges or immunities of being a citizen of a free government. And so the United States is
But the government in question was state government in Article 4.
Not yes, Your
the
Honor.
Federal government.
Well, it says that you are in no. If I may find the text again, it says that a citizen of a state shall be entitled to the privileges or immunities of citizens in the several states.
It's a non-discrimination principle.
In the several, yes, Your Honor.
You get the same rights when you cross state lines and go into another state that its state citizens have.
That's correct, Your Honor, but
So if you're injured, you can go to court and sue on the same terms that an in-state resident can go to court and sue.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that is encapsulated in the words other than privileges or immunities of citizens. That is encapsulated in shall be entitled to in the several states. In the several states is what's explaining, it's explaining where you are entitled to these equivalent rights. But as Justice Washington said, when he was describing those rights, those are not rights that are necessarily protected in every state. They are rights that are inalienable to an individual as a citizen of a free government. And if a state chooses to protect
that... As against the relevant government.
But only if that state chooses through some legally enforceable way to protect that individual right. But I don't think he was saying that it is necessarily the case that you are only entitled to those rights that are recognized in each individual state. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Mr. Dre.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Dominic Dre, and I represent the respondent, Crescent City Company. This is a case about the state's police power to protect the health and welfare of their citizens, and that's exactly what Louisiana has sought to do here. Faced with an industry...
How do you deal with the pretext argument, the argument that this legislation is rooted in bias and was the product of corruption and bribery? What are we to make of those arguments?
Well, I salacious, but unimportant. For one thing, as the court below explained, all the evidence of that was inadmissible as a matter of Louisiana evidentiary law. So none of that's actually in the record before this court. It was properly excluded as a matter of state law. Obviously, my client disputes it all and would be quick to point out that our legislature is one-third black, which is more than most of the northern states can boast.
How many French people are in it?
I don't know that.
Yeah, that's the allegation here, right? Is that French butchers are being discriminated against?
It's a rather interesting allegation that a legislature comprised one-third of people who were not allowed even to vote would take it upon themselves to discriminate against the French. But
really?
Be that as it may. however much of a stretch that is, just at the level of credulity, it certainly is not in the record and shouldn't be. None of that was admissible evidence. But there are important legal questions at issue in this case. We're talking about a state that, after the Civil War, lacked the resources to accomplish what it needed to protect its citizens' health and welfare. And lacking that, it turned to other solutions, including this monopoly. To prevail in their challenge, petitioners need to clear three hurdles. First, they need the Constitution to mean something else when it says privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Second, they need the unenumerated rights of Louisiana citizens to include the right to slaughter animals wherever a person chooses. And three, they need the state's regulation of that practice to lie beyond its traditional police powers. They fail in all three of those, but any one of them would be fatal to their case.
You haven't dealt with the monopoly issue, though, right? I thought Mr. Lynn was telling us that that's a critical part of the argument, that it's just restricted to these 17 people. How does that fit into your argument?
I take that to be a sort of attack, I guess, or a theory that says that somewhere in the 14th Amendment, we have a new protection against monopolies, which I don't see in that document anywhere. And in fact, the history leading up to this, I mean, yes, there are plenty of cases where states have rejected monopolies, but it's as a matter of state law. The Rumpf decision from Illinois, which my friend on the other side cites, is a perfect example. The state of Illinois, well known for its opposition to cronyist deals, struck down as a matter of state law a slaughterhouse monopoly not unlike the current one. That's perfectly fine, and that's what the states are for. The states protect all kinds of unenumerated rights, and so it was right for the Illinois Supreme Court to do that.
On what rationale, though? On the rationale that the law was in derogation of the common law and had to be strictly construed and survive a heightened standard of justification and failed?
I believe that's correct as an understanding of the common law of the state of Illinois.
That's just how rights, you know, natural rights claims work as a general matter. The right holder comes into court and says, I have this right, this law infringes the right, justify it. And so it's just a normal rights adjudication claim. It proves your opponent's point rather than the opposite, that there is a common law right to ply a trade and a monopoly that burdens that right or eliminates it is in derogation of that right and has to be strictly justified.
And in the state of Illinois, there is a common law for that very purpose. The federal government does not enforce a sort of federal common law.
Well, that's a whole question here about whether the 14th Amendment imports common law rights.
And indeed, this is where, as Your Honor asked earlier, where the other side's argument proves entirely too much, because it eliminates the entire purpose for having states, for having all of these states that carry out their roles as protecting a separate set of privileges and immunities.
Well, usually only when the state governments fail to protect rights. That's the whole point of the 14th Amendment, is it not? That
state governments in the...
We fought a war over that principle, by the way.
Yes, so we look to the text of the 14th Amendment, which itself makes very clear that these are separate citizenships, that people are citizens of two different governments. And in fact, it's sort of interesting that one sentence before the operative privileges or immunities clause in this case, the 14th Amendment refers to the definition of citizenship. So it says all persons born and naturalized in the United States, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Then it goes on to say that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And it stops. So one sentence before, the new amendment speaks in terms of citizenship of both the state and the federal government. And then it goes on to discuss the privileges or immunities attendant in your federal citizenship. Those are different from the privileges or immunities of a state. Otherwise, it would have just repeated that language. For the same reason, it could have just borrowed the language from Article 4. Because when we're trying to parse this new post-war amendment...
I understand your point, and I press Mr. Lynn on that. But wherever the phrase privileges or immunities has appeared, wherever it's appeared, it's always included the right to pursue lawful trade. I mean, take it back as far as you can into the English common law. It's always meant that. Not certain it's meant all the other things that Justice Washington claimed, but it's always meant that.
Well, even in Justice Washington's perhaps generous reading of what belongs to privileges or immunities, he explains that it's subject, nevertheless, to such restraints as the government may justly prescribe for the general good of the whole. And so this goes to the second problem with the other side, with the petitioner's argument, which is the idea that somehow their natural rights, well, first that they have natural rights that are protected through the federal constitution beyond those that have always been enforced by the federal government, and that those have to include the right to dump offal wherever they want to. That's not a law, I'm not aware of any case in this court or anywhere else, or even in England, that has allowed people to conduct slaughtering operations wherever they see fit.
Well, I don't think that's what Mr. Lynn was arguing. He seemed to argue that the state could have had a law that would have the slaughtering in a particular area, but you would still have competition within that area. I thought that he was that.
Yes, and so this gets to the point about whether the monopoly is somehow different in kind from any other police power regulation that the state may use. But we know that that's not the case because the Constitution itself sets up monopolies for patent holders, for example, and we have bridges. This court recently decided the Charles River Bridge case, which it allowed a second bridge to be built, but not because the monopoly for the first bridge was unconstitutional.
Well, what do you say to Mr. Lynn's point that in all those monopoly cases, it's a public function that's been delegated to a private entity, and that's not the case for butchers?
I disagree with that. It's a public function to keep offal out of the Mississippi River, and that's to deliver clean, safe drinking water to the people.
The point is you don't need a monopoly to do that. You don't need a monopoly to keep the waste.
Well, this
river.
Gets to the real request that Mr. Lynn and the petitioners are making of this court, which is to step in and second guess how the Louisiana legislature has chosen to exercise its police power.
Yeah, so when they choose to exercise it in a way that violates a long-standing fundamental right to pursue one's trade lawfully, that is our job, don't you think? Don't you think we have a role then?
Well, no, because the right in question, first of all, everyone's allowed to conduct their butchering operations. The only issue that Mr. Lynn can point to that is maybe an undesirable or maybe an uncommon feature of this system is the 25-year limited term monopoly. But for a number of reasons, I'll explain that that's actually pretty reasonable and pretty minimal encumbrance. For one thing, the state of Louisiana doesn't have the money to build the grand slaughterhouse, as the law itself says. The contracting parties are not getting some kind of sinecure that makes them rich overnight. It's an obligation on them. They have to build something of sufficient capacity to accommodate all butchers. If they fail to do so, they lose their charter. The prices are fixed by the legislature in the statute, so they can't engage in the one thing that really characterizes a monopoly as an economic matter, which is pricing power. The prices are all set in advance by the legislature. That actually should be viewed, frankly, as price protection for the petitioners in this case.
We don't have anything in the record as to what the prevailing prices were before this.
I'm unfamiliar with anything about the prevailing price beforehand, okay. Yes. But it's not left to the holders of the charter to set the price now. And so it could be changed, for that matter, as I understand it. There's no cost. Exclusive contract for the Crescent City Company serves two purposes that are totally legitimate in addition to the one of keeping offal out of the Mississippi River. Those are, it raises capital without the state spending money. The state of Louisiana is broke. It doesn't have money to be building new slaughterhouses. And the second purpose is it generates revenue. Fully 50% of the revenue that the governor's appointed inspector, again, there's normal government oversight of what's going on at these slaughterhouses, fully 50% of that revenue is devoted to the state's education fund. That's in Section 6 of the Act. This is a revenue-generating program that serves state interests of a variety of kinds. There's nothing about it that's so peculiar. As I've mentioned before, we have a postal monopoly. We have patents, which are limited term monopolies that are a lot like this 25-year monopoly. We have bridges. I cited the Charles River Bridge. We know about ferry programs that this court has reviewed, and at no time has it said that the mere fact that something is given in an exclusive way makes it an unconstitutional feature.
But once again, so, those are all public functions. They're very different than what we have here. What we have here is a group of men, a group of people who want to ply their trade by owning a slaughterhouse. That's what they're, and the state of Louisiana has forbidden them from doing that. That's different in kind than what you're discussing. What you need to convince me of is that there's nothing untoward about that decision.
Well, let me just
and the only thing I think you can rely on right now is the police power of the state of Louisiana, right?
Yes, and I think that's quite compelling when you consider the cholera and yellow fever that was ravaging the people of that state. But let me also just suggest that this public-private thing is illusory, because if I want to ply the trade of operating some machine that my neighbor owns the patent on, I can't do that. Monopolies work this way, and they're not unconstitutional. That's actually in the Constitution, the patenting process. So it's not, and by the way, my friend on the other side is trying to tease out this distinction between being a butcher, a lawful trade, and owning a slaughterhouse in which you do your butchering. I think that's cutting it pretty thin. That would suggest that somehow the trade changes based on whether or not the person owns the facility in which he's plying it. And that to me is an ask that involves inventing new rights as a product of the new amendment.
I'd like to go back to the threshold question about whether the 14th Amendment even applies in the first place, which is the primary question. The discussion thus far has focused on the justifications for the law and whether they're sufficient, and also the scope of the right that's being asserted. But we do have an important threshold constitutional question about whether the 14th Amendment is even engaged in this case. And as I understand the ratification history, the promulgation history and the ratification history, the point of the 14th Amendment, or one of the points of the 14th Amendment, was to put the Civil Rights Act of 1866 on firmer constitutional footing. And that act protects all kinds of rights that are classically and canonically state common law rights, the right to contract, the right to buy and sell property, et cetera, purchase, lease, and so forth. Those are classic common law rights. If the point was to put that important Civil Rights Act on a firmer constitutional footing, reading the Privileges or Immunities Clause in the 14th Amendment to include only a very narrow set of federal rights that are specifically enumerated wouldn't cover that.
So, a couple of things that I would like to respond to. One is the suggestion that somehow the 14th Amendment intended to constitutionalize what the Civil Rights Act of 2 years prior had said. That may be a perfectly noble objective, and perhaps some of the people who set out to frame the new amendment had that in mind. They did not, however, write that. They had the language before them from just 2 years earlier from the Civil Rights Act, and if they wanted to use that, they easily could have done so. The second point is, as to the anti-discrimination purpose or text and purpose of the Civil Rights Act, it says that all persons within the jurisdiction of the United States shall have the same right in every state or territory to make and enforce contracts, to sue, etc., as is enjoyed by white citizens. The law at issue here applies equally regardless of race. So even if the framers of the 14th Amendment had just lifted this language, which they did not do, and put that in the new amendment, we would be compliant because it's all available on the same terms to butchers of every race. Then there's a sort of follow-on concern, which I think the court should take very seriously, which is that the 14th Amendment includes in Section 5 some remarkable power for the federal government, and indeed specifically for federal courts, to go about overseeing and changing the laws of the states. And so if the purpose of this law is, or of this amendment is expanded to involve something more than what Your Honor characterized as a more limited set of rights, and I think that's the correct reading, if it's expanded to include all of the things covered by the Civil Rights Act or covered by Article 4, it would place the federal government and the courts in a position of remarkable authority in a way that it sort of surprises me that would be snuck in this rather roundabout manner, especially when 2 years prior the Congress had used more specific language when it meant to take over topics like enforcing contracts, suing, giving evidence, the full and equal benefit of all laws. This would be a backdoor revolution at the level of what state police powers are covered.
There's not much about the 14th Amendment that snuck in, is there? I mean,
The
14th Amendment has happened in our lifetime. It has reworked the United States Constitution and its relationship between the federal government and the states in a revolutionary way. That's the right word to use. It's revolutionary. So,
yes, exactly. And reading it as we do, to say that that the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States are codified against the states, that's what the narrowest reading which my client advances, that this applies to the first 8 amendments in the Bill of Rights, that is no mean achievement. That's an incredible accomplishment. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. That means that in all of the territories, all the states that had attempted to leave the Union and were brought back in kicking and screaming, they must now honor all of those rights in the first 8 amendments.
Plus habeas corpus.
So that, which I think is a reasonable right that's protected by the federal government. And that's no mean feat. And so sometimes with an eye on everything else that is protected by our various governments, there's a temptation to think that surely the 14th Amendment must have done everything. It's more than enough for this amendment to have brought in those first 8 amendments. Plus any other natural rights, even if the court wants to go that direction.
If it was meant to be just the first 8 amendments, then why didn't the 14th Amendment say the first 8 amendments? I mean, it's a very convoluted way of getting to the point you're trying to make for them to have used the words privileges or immunities.
I'm not sure that's so convoluted. I suppose one reason you wouldn't do that, and I'm just thinking about this now as we talk, is that any of those amendments could be repealed, and then you have a different first 8. But referring to the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States clearly encompasses those amendments. I suppose perhaps
it must mean more than that. It was part of the original Constitution before the Bill of Rights. In Article 4, it can't be referring to the Bill of Rights. It's got to be referring to something different.
So Article 4 is referring to the rights of citizens in the states when they're traveling in other states. And that, I think,
and they have something called privileges or immunities, right?
Correct. And earlier there was a little colloquy about what that might mean, and I think reading it as rights is a fair reading. But that doesn't change the subject matter of those rights. The question before the court today is about which of our governments protects which of our rights. And it's the whole point of the Corfield decision is to explain that the Article IV privileges and immunities, which are those belonging to citizens of the various states when they're traveling about, that those are an expansive list, too numerous for Justice Washington to list them all. That does not suggest that every time the words privileges and immunities appear close together, we're talking about the same list. You have to finish the phrase. Privileges or immunities of whom? Attending which of your two citizenships? This is one of the great achievements of our system of government generally, is that we have two governments that protect our rights, and they're different. And they also have, frankly, at the state level, the ability to experiment with all different manners of accomplishing that. So the other side would frankly collapse the entire system into one set of privileges and immunities, which both your state and your federal citizenship would entitle you to. And that would eliminate any real need for having states, frankly. So the invitation to second guess the Louisiana legislature's approach to solving a sort of pandemic in that state related to sickness from animal waste is more revolutionary even than the 14th Amendment set out to be. And to the extent that the first eight amendments are not enough, that's not the full meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, it would always have to be some privilege or immunity that's protected by the federal government, because they are still privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So whether that includes habeas corpus or the right to, for example, sue in federal court and avail yourself of the federal judiciary, whatever that content is going to be, it has to be something that has been historically enforced by the federal government by dint of a person's federal citizenship. With that, unless the court has anything further, I will yield the balance of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to pick up with the remarkable admission of my brother counsel that they concede that the Privileges or Immunities Clause at least includes the first eight amendments in the Bill of Rights. And so really, this case has just boiled down to the question, Your Honor, that you asked me, which is that all that is encompassed within privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, or is there more? And the conversation we were having, Your Honor, at the end of my time, the point I was trying to make is it would be an awfully stingy understanding of the rights of federal citizenship to say that the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States is limited only to those first eight amendments. I think what that phrase is saying is there's privileges or immunities of being a citizen of the United States, which is a free government. Like other free governments, all citizens of this free government have certain fundamental
Lynn,
rights.
Mr. Lynn, if I were to agree with you that the Privileges or Immunities Clause means more than just the Bill of Rights, and if I were to agree with you that it includes the right to apply one's trade lawfully, what do you do with your friend's argument that Louisiana simply doesn't have the money to allow for more slaughterhouses, that this is just a reasonable way to approach, the word he used was a pandemic. What about the no money argument?
I don't think, Your Honor, with all due respect to my friend, I don't think the no money argument is part of your police power. The fact that you just don't have money, I don't think is a justification of the exercise of police power. I think the police power is exercised to protect the health and safety of the citizens. And there is nothing in the no money argument that suggests that there is a health and safety problem with having competition in the founding, establishment, and running of a slaughterhouse within whatever space the state of Louisiana deems is necessary to protect the public health
Okay. What do you do with his patent monopolies argument? He said that that's not a public use necessarily.
The patent monopolies argument is that the answer to that is very similar to the public-private franchise distinction, which is if you go back in history and back to the statute of monopolies under King James, you will find that that carves out patents as a certain kind of monopoly that was understood to be separate from other monopolies that were opposed to the common law. So the answer to his question is, patents are special. They always have been, and we're not denying that they are, in the same way that public franchises like railroads and other common carriers are. I guess the last point that I wanted to make is there was an impassioned plea for federalism from my brother counsel about how our reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause would make it unnecessary to have states at all. Frankly, that there is no merit to that argument. We have said, first of all, there's a couple answers to that, that states can impose reasonable regulation even in areas where there are fundamental rights. And each state can decide to its own accord and with respect to its own citizens what reasonable regulations are necessary to infringe on various trades. States can also protect more rights than the fundamental rights.
And but it does shift considerable power to the Congress to regulate a vast area and considerable power to the federal courts to adjudicate just a vast array of rights claims.
Yes,
there
Your
isn't
Honor.
There isn't a limiting principle that I can see.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would posit that that shift is not something that the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment would be surprised by. And I suspect that if we were to go forward in history 100+ years, we would find that the 14th Amendment will be read as a font of unenumerated rights, whatever this court holds today.
And I noticed your friend did not use the phrase laboratories of democracy because it hadn't been said yet.
And with that, the butcher's rest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.
No, why don't we rule from the bench?
Not a chance.